Just a quick note on this week's episode. The way we think about ourselves and refer to ourselves and the way we want others to think about us and refer to us is extremely important. Today's episode revolves around the first people to inhabit Illinois, and we've asked the people who you'll hear from about what language and which terms they prefer for themselves and their groups. Because we got a range of answers, you'll hear a range of terms used. Many of the states bordering Illinois have Indian reservations. Wisconsin is home to the Potawatomi, Ojibwe, Ho-Chunk, Menominee, and Oneida Nations, among others. In Michigan, you'll find the Potawatomi, Ojibwe, and Odawa, and in Iowa, the Sac and Fox. But there are no reservations in Illinois. Yet all across Illinois, there are hundreds of daily reminders that we are living on land once inhabited by Native Americans. You see it in the names of towns, streets, rivers, and our sports teams. Even the name Chicago is believed to come from a word Native Americans gave to the wild onions that grew all around the shores of Lake Michigan. So why aren't there any Indian reservations in Illinois? I'm Curious City's Jason Mark. Understanding the answer to this question requires a look back at the region's history from the 1700s through the 1830s. It's a period marked by armed conflicts, treaty negotiations, and a U.S. government determined to push out Native people. Coming up, three Native Americans, two of whom are professors, the other a chairman of a Potawatomi band, tell us the story of how the indigenous people of Illinois lost their lands and their decades-long fight to have their histories and contributions to this area recognized.
Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org.
Federal funding is gone, and that changes everything. Every day this gap lingers, the shows and reporting you rely on are at risk. We've still got $200,000 left to close our funding gap. We're making progress, but we're not there yet. The programs and conversations you count on every day depend on your support. When you give now, you help close the gap and keep trusted, independent news here for Chicago. Make an affordable monthly gift online at wbez.org/donate.
Our creation stories tell us that there was a great flood. The world essentially emerged then on the back of a turtle. So we live on Turtle Island. My name is John Lau, and I'm an associate professor at The Ohio State University at the Newark campus. I'm also a proud citizen of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians. Our ancestral lands went from Door County up in Wisconsin down through what's now known as Chicago, down through Illinois. And then that swath went over following somewhat closely the Michigan-Indiana state line, over to Detroit, and then down into the Maumee River Valley of Ohio. So we were a very strong tribe with a lot of territory.
There was an abundance of game animals there where you could go and hunt and fish, deer, fish, you know, even bison. All of those animals, the land, the trees, the things that grow, we're all connected to that. Part of our belief is that the Creator put a lot of those things in place for us to survive and to live off of, as long as we show respect to those things that we use and take. My name is Joseph Rupnick. I'm the chairman for the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation.
you know, we're not monolithic. We didn't all attack the cavalry on horseback with, you know, a feather in the back of our head in the 1850s. Some of us were fisher folk. Some of us were farmers. You know, some were hunters and gatherers. And we represent all kinds of traditions, and we have different languages and customs. My taxpayer name is Patricia Lowe, and my Ojibwe name is Waswakonokwe. It means torchlight on the water woman. I am a professor in the Medill School of Journalism, and I direct the Center for Native American and Indigenous Research here at Northwestern. Native people had a relationship with land. I mean, you talk to people in the Menominee Nation and they'll say, we are the forest. You talk to people in my community and we'll say, you know, we are the wild rice. We have such an intimate relationship with the plants and animals, the other than human beings in our communities.
In 1803, the Potawatomi were the dominant tribe in the Chicago area, with the Ho-Chunk, Sauk, and Fox farther to the north than the west. That year, the United States bought 828,000 square miles of land from France. It was known as the Louisiana Purchase, and it extended from the Mississippi River to the Rocky Mountains. At that point, President Thomas Jefferson began the process of moving indigenous people west of the Mississippi, including the native peoples in northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin.
Illinois was just too good of a land to bother to share with Indian peoples, and so we all got removed. The Indians that are in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, for instance, are primarily in the northern parts of the state that were clear cut for their timber, mined for their copper and iron.
The geography of Illinois was such that it was conducive to farming and mining and its value as a port. I think that's the difference between Illinois and, say, Minnesota, Wisconsin, or Michigan, where the land was heavily timbered and much more difficult to settle for farming and other uses. Farming was never going to be a huge industry in the northern part of the state of Wisconsin, where you find Indian nations today. This area was identified as a land really rich in resources, particularly lead. And if you remember from your history, the British still had a pretty big presence here, especially in the Great Lakes region. So the Americans were nervous about ammunition. They wanted the lead mines that were in this lead-producing region in western Illinois.
You know, they wanted to dispossess us with honor, they called it. And that honor was that they would chip away and piecemeal our lands away from us rather than fighting a war over it. They would go through villages and they would find somebody willing to sign a treaty. And so the federal government didn't bother itself with worrying about always whether these were the recognized leaders of the tribes. The bottom line is we're taking the land. The land is going to go. This is an opportunity for you to negotiate your best deal.
I think it was either, you know, sign this treaty, give up this land, or die.
You know, that whole concept of communal usage of land versus individual private property is really a foreign concept. The Indian leaders are saying, well, you talk about these lines. You're asking us to identify the lands that are ours. It's not ours. You know, we don't own it.
In 1830, Congress passed the Indian Removal Act.
President Andrew Jackson's policy was, you know, Indian removal. and they wanted to get as many Indians out of there and remove them as far away as they could, basically to say, you know, kick them west of the Mississippi and let them be somebody else's problem.
The act forced tens of thousands of Native Americans from their homes in the east to lands west of the Mississippi River. Prior to 1830, Native Americans signed a number of treaties that had specifically allowed them to stay on their land. So there was confusion and anger over this new policy.
Black Hawk was a war chief, and I think he'd had enough of the U.S. government. And they had planted corn and wanted to go and harvest their corn. When his band was told to get out of Illinois, Black Hawk refused and led the U.S. military and the Illinois militia on an odyssey that ended badly at the Bad Axe Massacre near La Crosse, Wisconsin.
My fourth great-grandfather, Chief Chauvinet, during the Black Hawk Wars, he went and warned the settlers in that area that Black Hawk was coming through and that he asked them to leave or vacate the area. He had become what was called the friend of the settlers in Illinois. Earlier in his life, he was a war chief. He did fight, you know, against the Americans, the British, and everybody else. I think after 60 years of fighting, was finally tired of it. And maybe it was an act of survival to say, let's try and see if we can live peacefully together and see what we can retain and hang on to.
We'll be right back.
Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org.
America is changing, and so is the world.
But what's happening in America isn't just the cause of global upheaval. It's also a symptom of disruption that's happening everywhere.
I'm Asma Khalid in Washington, D.C.
I'm Tristan Redman in London, and this is The Global Story.
Every weekday, we'll bring you a story from this intersection, where the world and America meet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Hawk War intensified the fear and hatred that many white settlers felt toward the region's indigenous people. The idea of moving Native Americans west of the Mississippi seemed to take on new urgency, and tribal leaders found they had few options at the negotiating table. Which leads us to September 1833. The U.S. government called thousands of Potawatomi, Odawa, and Ojibwe to gather in Chicago. Under pressure from U.S. officials, the Native Americans signed the Treaty of Chicago, surrendering 5 million acres of land in northeast Illinois and southeast Wisconsin.
And, of course, the Native people often didn't understand the terms that the U.S. negotiators were using. It's a really coercive process.
The federal government brought in the barrels of whiskey before the negotiations started and got all the Indians liquored up. And liquored up Indians aren't the best negotiators.
During those treaty talks in Chicago, there was one Potawatomi leader who successfully secured a place where his people could continue to live in Michigan, Leopold Pokagan.
He was a signer of the Treaty of 1833. He was a teetotaler. He kept the Pokagon Potawatomi camp away from the other Indian camps and away from the whiskey wagons. And as a result, he was able to negotiate an exemption for the Pokagon Potawatomi. And that's why we didn't get removed. And that's why we're in Southwest Michigan and Northwest Indiana to this day. We're the closest federally recognized Indian tribe to Chicago. We're about 60 miles away. That's only because we had a very wise leader of the time.
While they allowed Polk Hagen's band to remain, federal troops forced most of the other Potawatomi to march west.
They started in Indiana, over by Twin Lakes, Chief Menominee's village. The federal militia had come to Menominee's village and said, "Oh, we got a big surprise for you. Please assemble at the church on a certain day and time." And they did, and the federal soldiers surrounded the church and started marching them west. That was the big surprise for them. And then as they moved west, they swept up whatever Potawatomi Indians there were in other parts of Indiana and Illinois and cleaned out the whole area. There are newspaper reports from the time that most of the people were made to walk. And when they walked through Springfield, Illinois, the white people came out, and it was such a sad and pitiful sight. The newspapers report that the white people cried for the Indians. It was so distressing. People died along the way, particularly the sick, the old, and the very young babies. And they oftentimes wouldn't allow people to even stop and do a burial. You just had to keep moving. And so it becomes a death march.
Some of those, while they were en route, escaped. Some of them went back up north, hid in the forest, and eventually those ones there established their own reservation in those different areas. For the Prairie Band, we eventually wound up in Council Bluffs, Iowa. My great-grandfather was born there. We tried to establish a reservation there. The government just signed a treaty with the Osage Nation in Kansas, and that land became available. And with the help of one of our interpreters, Billy Coldwell, negotiated the treaty for us here in 1846, where we eventually occupied this land.
Billy Coldwell. You might know that name. On Chicago's northwest side, there's Caldwell Avenue and the Billy Caldwell Golf Course. Caldwell was multiracial, and Chicagoans will be familiar with his Indian name because it's the name of a northwest side neighborhood, Sauganash. And Caldwell plays another important role in this story because, while it's true that there are no Indian reservations in Illinois, some treaties did include land grants that reserved pieces of Illinois land for a handful of Native Americans. Caldwell got 1,600 acres in an area now known as Caldwell Woods on Chicago's far northwest side. Later, he sold off most of it. Another land grant went to French trader Antoine Wilmette and his Potawatomi wife, Archange. Their land was where the suburb of Wilmette is today, but eventually, they were forced out as white settlers continued to flood the area. Joseph Rupnik's ancestor, Chief Chabanet of the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation, negotiated for around 1,200 acres of land for his people in DeKalb County. Chabanet lived there for a time, but he'd also go west to visit the tribe's reservations in Iowa and Kansas. And during one trip, the U.S. government claimed he abandoned the land and sold it off to white settlers.
He didn't abandon it. And, you know, to kind of further back up that claim, once those white settlers were squatting on his land, he actually tried to sell it. And it went all the way up to the president where they said, "No, you can't sell that. This is your land by treaty." But he couldn't occupy it again because of everybody else that was living on there. He fought for that land his whole time. My grandparents fought for that land. My mother, who was chairman, fought for this land too. And so we've been trying to battle this for, you know, 170 years.
In 2006, the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation bought around 130 acres of land near Shabona, a town that's named for Chief Chabanet, in north-central Illinois.
November 18th of this year, we finally got a bill introduced. Senator Moran introduced the bill, S-3242, that we're hoping Congress will act on that to reinstate our claim on that original territory.
If Kansas Senator Jerry Moran's bill is passed, it would acknowledge that the land was not abandoned by Chief Chabanet and his people, and the sale of the land by the government was illegal. The bill would also provide monetary compensation to the tribe for that land and recognition of tribal government authority. In addition to the legal components, there's also a spiritual aspect to any potential return of the land.
You know, there are a lot of grave sites that are up in that area too. And we're specifically looking at, you know, can we intern them back on some of the ground that we have, or possibly identify some graves where Chabanet's land was. Hopefully we can get some of our ancestors' remains interned.
Over the years, other Potawatomi have argued that they have a claim on Chicago's lakeshore. Much of the land we see today on the city's lakefront was added as landfill over the past 150 years. So, when the Potawatomi signed away their land in 1833, they didn't sign away that land.
We never ceded the lake. We never ceded the lake bed. If you dump a bunch of stuff into it and make it dry, we never ceded that. And we'd like our lakefront, or at least an acknowledgement that it is Potawatomi land. The Supreme Court, in a very short decision, made a curious remark of, they surely must have abandoned it by now. We never abandoned it. I don't know what we were expected to do, keep canoes out there 24/7. It didn't make any sense. How can you abandon land that is covered by water?
In recent years, there have been attempts to call attention to what we've been talking about here, that Illinois was once populated by Native Americans and that they were forced out. They're called land acknowledgments. Places like Steppenwolf Theater, the Newberry Library, and Northwestern University post these land acknowledgments on their websites, in their buildings, or announce them at the beginning of events.
If it's just words that are recited before a gathering of some kind, you know, I don't think that anybody really finds that meaningful. But if land acknowledgments lead to conversations between indigenous people of that area and the settler communities that have emerged on that land, then I think it can be a really good thing.
It's fine to say I'm on the land of somebody, but we shouldn't be living guilt-free on stolen land, right? And the point is not to make everybody guilt-ridden. The point is to promote truth and reconciliation. And reconciliation comes through that idea of, well, how can we make things right? How can we make amends for the taking of those lands? And it's never too late to make amends.
Those were the voices of John Lau, Patty Lowe, and Joseph Rupnik. Thanks to Robert Lorzel for his extensive reporting and for conducting the interviews for this story. Thanks also to historian Ann Durkin Keating, author of Rising Up from Indian Country, The Battle of Fort Dearborn and the Birth of Chicago, for her help with this episode. And thanks to Nate Steinfeld for asking his question about why there are no Indian reservations in Illinois. If you want to learn more about the history we covered on today's episode, we've got a list of books and resources to check out on our website at wbez.org/curiouscity. Curious City is produced by me and Joe Dassault. Linda Lutton reports. Maggie Civet is our digital and engagement producer. Sophia Lowe and Paloma Moreno Jimenez are our interns, and Alexandra Solomon edits the show. Curious City is supported by the Conant Family Foundation. I'm Jason Mark. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you back here next week.